at the university, they had to consult Ledard, L-E-N-A-R-D, and Stark, S-T-A-R-K, as to his suitability. One of these elderly czars said, "I do not know Bonhoeffer, but I do know that he studied with Haber, who was a non-Aryan, and that his methods must therefore be impure." Haber, at the time, was a world-leading physical chemist whose discovery of ammonia synthesis before the First World War had made it possible for the Germans to prolong the war for 2 years longer than would have been possible in the absence of this method, which was an initial step in the manufacture of explosives. In spite of the opposition of Stark and Ledard, the university succeeded in bringing Bonhoeffer to Leipzig, ultimately. Bly had been born in Holland and had retained his Dutch citizenship and was therefore able to keep at least partially clear of the Nazis. He told me that Heisenberg, the great German theoretical physicist who was director of the Institute of Theoretical Physics at Leipzig, had indicated no enthusiasm for Nazism, but had felt that it might be his duty to join up with the Nazis in order to help to rescue science from the hands of Ledard and Stark. Something of the sort evidently occurred, because many years later, Heisenberg was the principal real physicist in the German nuclear bomb work. He was not in Leipzig when I visited there in late April of 1945. I talked with Professor Friedrich Hund, H-U-N-D, a theoretical physicist of some eminence, whom I had known very slightly in the past. Hund was a small, pleasant-looking, middle-aged man who was very friendly, but conveyed no useful information. Then I was given the impression that another physicist, whose name I believe was Dirpel, was available, but probably would not be friendly. When I talked to him, I found him disagreeable looking and definitely hostile in attitude. I had no recollection of his being there during my visit 12 years earlier, but he seemed to know about it. He said formally, once you came here as a guest of the Institute, and now you come with a hostile army. This was quite true, but the snarling manner in which he said it angered me. And I indicated that I was here because of the Germans had made the war. It was all rather futile, and the discussion was futile, and in my anger, my German ability largely evaporated. Hunt, who was standing not far away, sensed that things were not well, and when I terminated the discussion with Dirpel, he, who was the last man I was to talk to, Hunt shook his head sadly and escorted me in kindly fashion to the door of the Institute. He was the last man visible to me of the Institute staff. He was a pathetic little figure clad in mountain climbing costume, probably all that was left of his wardrobe after many years of war. Leipzig had been badly damaged by bombing. As we drove through the main square of the city, the Hotel Haufe, H-A-U-F-E, where I had lived during my earlier visit to Leipzig. Loomed up in fragments, which extended just about to the floor where I had lived. During my stay there, Joseph Goebbels had dined at the next table to me, and later Hitler and his and most of his gang had stayed during a meeting of the Saxon division of the Nazi Party. This had involved a meetings in the Leipzig Fair Hall and a great parade of 100,000 brown shirts through the square. During this 4-hour march, I stood wedged in a crowd close to the reviewing stand, a low platform which raised Hitler, and Hitler alone, above, slightly above, the long column of marchers. He stood there hour after hour, saluting, returning the salute of the marchers. I was told a day or two later by one of the marchers that Hitler had seemed to look into the eye of every man and return the salute given by every man. He had a strange magnetism for the Nazi rabble. I happened to be standing in the lobby of the hotel when he came through. I and an American family were the only guests left in the hotel, and for some reason we were all standing in the lobby. As he came through, everyone leapt to attention, and everyone but with one exception gave the Nazi salute, which Hitler returned in casual fashion. He looked hard at the one man who had not given the salute, and I felt rather uncomfortable, but nothing happened to me. At another time during the day, I came out of my room on an upper floor and started to walk down the stairs. On the flight of stairs just below my flight, I could hear two men in conversation. One was speaking in a very rich voice, wholly dominating the conversation. I believe that this was Hitler. I listened but could not catch any words, only the dominance of one man over the other. This rich, full voice was very different from the angry snarl of Hitler's voice on the radio. Throughout Hitler's stay in the hotel, the building was surrounded by a guard of 500 rifle-bearing Schutz Polizei, S-C-H-U-T-Z-P-O-L-I-Z-E-I. This was very different from the guard of the Austrian Chancellor when he visited my hotel in Salzburg later in the summer. Chancellor Dollfuss wandered alone through the lobby of the hotel, one rifle-bearing sentry walked up and down in front of the entrance. Hitler lived to bring on a world war. Dollfuss, an unassuming and harmless little man, was assassinated a few months after I saw him. After finding the heavy water at Osterode, we returned. After leaving Leipzig, we found the heavy water at Osterode and returned to Göttingen. Now our big objective was Hartek's Institute at the University of Hamburg. But Hamburg was still in the hands of the German army. I therefore waited at Göttingen, occupying myself with visiting institutes and talking to various Germans, waiting for the imminent fall of Hamburg. On May 3rd, word came over the radio that Hamburg was to surrender to British troops on the following morning. Unfortunately, on that day, I seemed to be coming down with flu, and the weather was unpromising in the extreme. However, I went to to an army medical clinic in Göttingen to see what could be done. The ranking medical man present was a corporal who was well provided with large antibiotic pills. He administered two of these to me and gave me a few more, and presently I began to feel better. The following morning was cold and drizzly, and we started for Hamburg. As we approached the city, after a long drive, we began to pass truckloads of German prisoners being transported out of the city to camps, to prison camps, where they could be cared for. We continued. It was interesting to see these trucks crowded with German troops, so crowded that in many trucks they could not sit down. The trucks were open and exposed to the drizzle, and the prisoners did not look happy. We continued on to the outskirts, where in the early evening we located quarters, sleeping quarters, in a house occupied by British officers. The following morning I was duly wakened at 7 o'clock by a British enlisted man who offered me tea in the British fashion. I declined it, got some breakfast, and my driver and I started out to find the Physical Institute of the university. The city was seemingly quiet, as I recall it, and we had no serious difficulty in finding a university where the institute that I was seeking was guarded by British troops. In particular, a young second lieutenant was commanding the small detachment guarding the institute. We had no problem in finding Professor Hartek. Who not only was a well-known physical chemist, but later was discovered to have been possibly the most effective scientist in the Germans' nuclear bomb effort. Hartek was pleasant, but not outgoing. He had been concerned, as we knew, with the isotope separation by means of the centrifuge, which we had found previously in the silk factory at Celle. He outlined the work of his institute and we also visited the Physical Institute, and we visited the Physical Institute as well as the Chemistry Institute. We learned that something was to be seen in a nearby, in a village, not far from Hamburg. And went out to locate, to this village, to locate a small dairy where a Norwegian, strangely enough, had built a so-called Betatron, Betatron. This was a device. This particular instrument was like a large glass donut, perhaps 2.5 or 3 feet in diameter, and contained electrodes which circulated a beam of electrons round and round, building up energy until they could be, had sufficient energy to bombard a target. This was not a new principle, being similar, being somewhat analogous to the cyclotron, but the particular type of instrument was unfamiliar to me. The Norwegian inventor and the Norwegian designer and constructor was not present. I learned later that he had subsequently returned to Norway, where after the war he was dealt with as a traitor. When we returned through Hamburg, we had a chance to observe the destruction wrought by repeated bombing. The newspapers, the Allied newspapers, had announced many weeks before that after one particularly severe bombing, that Hamburg, the city of Hamburg, had ceased to exist. In our observation, this was true for some 3 or 4 blocks near the outskirts. Here, several factories had been completely destroyed, but the major buildings in the heart of the city were virtually intact. A good many houses had their roofs stove in, but the total damage seemed much less than in some other cities that we had had a chance to observe. new paragraph. After three nights in the Hamburg area, we returned to Göttingen to report what we had found. Alsace immediately sent a second expedition with the necessary number of military men.